You're listening finally to Mentoring Developers, episode 66. Welcome back.
Welcome to Mentoring Developers, the podcast for new and aspiring software developers, where we discuss your struggles, anxieties, and career choices. And now, here's your host, Arsalan Ahmed.
Hello and welcome again to Mentoring Developers, a podcast for new and aspiring software developers. This is our first episode of 2018, and I'm really excited to bring you our new lineup of guests. You would have noticed a pretty long gap between episodes 65 and this episode, episode 66. I apologize for that delay, and I hope that you'll stick around because 2018 is looking very exciting. We will, of course, continue bringing you new guests, and we will talk to people, we'll get their stories, and we'll try to find out what makes them who they are and see how they can inspire us to reach our own goals. I've also started teaching young kids, kids from kindergarten through eighth grade, about software development, about programming. I'm really excited about being able to do that. I'm doing it in person in a classroom environment, and I'm also doing it online. So this has been really rewarding for me, and I really want to share some of my experiences on this podcast and also on YouTube. So that's my big reveal. We are going to have a YouTube channel, and I'm really hoping that you're going to visit that channel and benefit from those videos. Those will be short videos, 5 to 15 minutes, maybe up to 20 minutes, but those videos will be targeting specific topics that concern you. And we will probably bring some content over from some of the podcast episodes, some of the real gems, something you can take away and you could be proud of and you can share with your friends and hopefully inspire all of your family and friends to think about software development as a viable career for you. That's the whole point of this podcast, and that's the whole point of everything that I do around this podcast. The YouTube channel is not active right now. There are no videos posted. So stay tuned. Keep listening to this podcast. Keep supporting us if you believe in our mission. And we will share it with you when the videos become available, when the YouTube channel is active, and we'll invite you to come over and give us a view. And then we'll talk about more interesting, exciting things that we'll do along the way. But the most important thing is that you guys and girls out there who are listening to this podcast, you benefit from our experiences, and hopefully we will be able to enrich your lives in some way. So without further ado, let's start our episode 66. This is a good one. In this episode, I'll be talking to Damian Brady from Microsoft. Damian is a cloud developer advocate specializing in DevOps. After spending a year in Toronto, Canada, he returned to Australia, the land of the dangerous creatures and beautiful beaches, in 2018. Damian used to work as a developer at Octopus Deploy, and he was a Microsoft MVP. He has a background in software development and consulting in a broad range of industries. In Australia, he co-organized the Brisbane .NET user group and launched the Domain-Driven Design Brisbane conference, which is awesome. And he speaks at conferences, he speaks at user groups, and he's been a guest on really amazing podcasts like .NET Rocks and Hansel Minutes. Not only that, he has his own Channel 9 show. Channel 9 is a website where you can see videos and learn about Microsoft technologies. And the name of that show is the DevOps Lab. You'll see links for that in the show notes for this episode, which will be mentoringdevelopers.com/episode66. And on top of all that, he's a really nice guy. So I'm really excited to bring to you Damian Brady. All right, here we go. Hi, everyone. Today, my guest is Damian Brady. Damian, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
Doing fantastic. You are not in the US. You're actually somewhere else. Where are you right now?
I'm in Australia at the moment, East Coast in a place called Newcastle, which is about 2 hours north of Sydney.
Right. So is it true that it's summertime over there and it's really hot and sunny in where you live?
It's very much summertime. It's been 30 something degrees every day, which is Celsius. Oh, I can't do the conversion. We're talking 90s, I think.
Wow. So, well, I live in Ohio, and we've had lots of snowstorms this time of the year. So we are not very far from Canada, where you lived for a while. What were you doing there?
Yeah, I was living in Toronto for 12 months, basically for my wife's work. I went over there with her. I'm lucky enough to be able to work pretty much from anywhere in the world. So I went over there for a year, and we just got back to Australia maybe 2 weeks ago. So it was a bit of a change. It was minus 28 Celsius, which is probably pretty close to that in Fahrenheit when we left Toronto and got here, and it was plus 30 or in the 90s, I think, when we got to Brisbane, where I used to live in Australia, and we've come down to Newcastle, which is where we're living now.
Yeah, the world is a large place and the climates are so different, and it's just amazing to meet people from different parts of the world. It's really good to have somebody from Australia on our podcast. We haven't had that before. And Great. You currently work at Microsoft as a, what's your title again?
I'm a cloud developer advocate at Microsoft.
Yeah. So we're going to unpack that in a little bit. But first I want to hear from you about something interesting that happened in your career when you're starting out, when you're a student, you're in college, and you're working on a voting system for the Australian elections. What happened there?
It was interesting. I was in my third year of my IT degree. We had a group project which involved a few people. We split up our tasks a little bit, and the project was to write an online, like electronic, or not online, but electronic voting system. So everybody would submit their votes, and it would follow the Australian federal voting system, which has preference, allocations, and all sorts of fancy stuff that happens with the Australian election. My part of the project was to write the algorithm that actually counted the votes, which was right up my alley. But I needed to get a couple of questions answered. Namely, like the biggest one was, what happens if two people have exactly the same number of votes? So I went to the political science department at the university and spoke to a professor there. And it shocked me at the time that there wasn't actually an answer. The answer he gave me was, we do a recount and then there's a different number that comes out, which is fine for, well, I don't know whether you'd say it's fine, but it's understandable when you have a bunch of humans counting paper votes, but a computer's probably not going to get a different answer each time. So I think what that kind of taught me is that without that conversation, I probably would have just made an assumption or skipped that requirement or something like that. But having that conversation with somebody who might end up, using a system was really, really important for finding out what bits needed to be further defined. And the conversation is really the thing that happens to get real software working the way that people need it to.
I think the biggest difference that I see between somebody who's starting out in software development and who's a veteran, the veterans, they are more jaded and they tend not to trust the initial set of requirements that are given. And they know that when they dig deeper, when they think about the problem in detail, when they actually show the user how a potential system will work, sometimes our understandings are so different. So until you really dig deeper, you really don't know. It's not all about writing code, right? It's more than that. It's about doing the right thing, right? And sometimes it's hard to know. Yeah. And maybe that's the hardest thing in software development.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. I mean, I've done a whole bunch of jobs over the last 15 years or so. And I think writing code is probably the bit that everybody can do. Actually, having conversations with people and realizing that, exploring the requirements a little bit more than what's just written on paper is an absolutely necessary part of it. We've always heard the thing in software development where the user doesn't know what they want, or the product manager or product owner, doesn't know what they want. They ask for something, and then you deliver that exact thing, and then they decide they didn't want that after all. That's just a known thing with more you know, experienced developers, I suppose. But whether you become jaded and say, well, I'm never going to get this right, I may as well just do my best, you know, write the best code I can, or whether you go the other way and say, well, the best thing to do would be to work together and have a conversation and sit down with the person and deliver something really early that they can see and, you know, shape the direction they want the software to go. That's kind of the two directions I've seen people go in software development a lot of the time.
So the modern trend in, especially in smaller organizations, is to use agile methodologies. And by that they mean, they mean that they are not going to assume that they know exactly what to do right up front. They're going to assume that we don't, they don't, and they're going to take it one step at a time, take a little, or let's say that they are going to iterate. So imagine there's a for loop going 100 times, and every time you learn a little bit more, and then you make a little bit more of that software. So that is something that is not thought up in a meeting with a standards committee has decided that we need to do this. We are doing this because we have found that all other methods are not working.
Yeah. Right.
So
yeah, it's really like Agile kind of came out of that acknowledgement that at the start of the project, that's when you know the least about what's happening. You know the least about what the requirements really are right at the start. So the idea of defining everything to the nth degree right up front and then trying to implement that over the period of, 6 months, 12 months or something like that is inevitably going to lead to something which maybe isn't exactly what you need at the time. So Agile was a reaction to that to say, well, let's acknowledge that and accept it and do it iteratively, like you said, just do a little bit at a time and realize that, we're fallible as humans. We may not know everything up front and, we can change the direction based on what's happening in the environment as well.
Right. So I want to change tracks a little bit. I want to talk to you about your initial days, how you started, and not just how you got your first job, but why did you want to be a developer? What was your first encounter with programming? When did you first realize that's a thing somebody can do?
Well, I was lucky, actually. My dad was fairly interested in technology. He's a solicitor or a lawyer in Australia. And he was really interested in these new computer things that were being made available to the public. And so we had a computer at home quite early. It was an old one from my dad's work, and then at some point we got an Amiga 500. It was, and we used to, Dad and I actually kind of bonded a little bit over writing code with Amiga Basic. It was, so we were buying computer magazines, and at the time this is how you'd learn to write code. You'd buy the computer magazines, and then there'd be a few pages of code that you'd have to copy to get something working. And I realized that you could tweak little bits of that code and make changes. And it kind of became this thing that felt really powerful to be able to make this device do what you wanted it to do, just little games and things like that. So it was really early. It was probably around when I was 10 or so, I would have written my first software that was my own code, I think. So that was the initial kind of exposure to this world of computers and programming, and I maintained an interest, I guess, while I was at school and high school, but I actually went into music after high school. I got this false impression at university that writing code was going to be, turning up every day and typing stuff out based on, a really strict specification that was sitting next to me, and it would just be this really boring thing. Almost like almost like data entry, I think. And that was an incorrect impression, I've since learned. But at the time, that's what I thought software development was. So I went and did a year at the Conservatorium of Music in Brisbane until I realized that doing that all day, every day was kind of taking the enjoyment out of music. And so I experimented with a few other degrees, a few other courses at university, found programming again as one of the courses that I did, and went straight back to that. And I've been there ever since, really.
That's great. What kind of music were you interested in? Were you an instrumentalist?
Yeah, I actually played jazz trombone which is a slightly unusual one. But I think the main reason I started playing that is my dad played trombone, so we had one in the house, which was very convenient. But I also learned piano when I was younger. So I play piano and I used to play trombone, but I haven't picked that up in about 10 years. So I don't know whether I could anymore. but it was jazz mainly, and I still enjoy like just jumping down at a piano and playing what I'm hearing from the radio and things like that.
That's great. For the longest time, I wanted to play the electric guitar.
Yes.
You know, it's typical. There's nothing unusual about this. So the reason I got into programming is because I wanted to make video games, which is also very typical. And I wanted to be, you know, a rock star. I wanted to play the electric guitar. And so I never had an electric guitar until I had a friend who was a very good guitarist, and I was buying a guitar for him because he needed a car. So I drove him to a guitar store and was looking for guitars for him. And I said, "Hey, do you think you can help me buy a guitar for myself?" So I ended up buying a guitar. It was a very cheap Squire, and it was very good. I loved it. I didn't know, you know, I didn't know what I didn't know, and I just was horrible at it because I never took a lesson. And I said, okay, let me enroll in college. I was in college. Maybe I'll change majors. Well, they'll teach me how to become a musician. I mean, they'll teach me how to play guitar. It's music major. I went through the requirements, and it turns out you already need to be a musician. You need to be a good enough musician before they let you in. And I was really confused. And I was thinking, what's the point? If I'm really good, then I don't need to go. So that was a really interesting part of my life. But so I have a tremendous respect for musicians, especially the ones when they go to music school. They're already pretty good.
Yeah, I studied, I had lessons, I did all that kind of stuff before that, you know, phase of my life. So actually when I went there, it turned out I thought I was pretty good. And when I went to the conservatorium, it turned out I was not actually very good at all. I was quite good at the theory, which has a bit of a maths component to it, I suppose. But if you put me on the stage next to any other trombone player in that entire building, and probably even a bunch of people who don't play trombone, I was probably not going to be, you know, in the top half of the players on the stage. There's a very good chance I'd be the worst trombone player in that building at the time. So I completely appreciate what you mean. The standard just to get into those things was much higher than I could kind of cope with, I think, in the long term. You already need to be able to play.
So you didn't... You didn't do a music major. Did you go to school? Did you go to college? And did you get a computer science or computer engineering degree? What were you doing there in college?
Yeah, so after the conservatorium, I went there for a year, decided that with my ability and you know, how much I'm enjoying it, I was never going to be able to make a living from this. And it was kind of not really helping my love of music. So I went to a university and did enrolled in a general science degree, a Bachelor of Science. I did a bunch of really unusual subjects or unrelated subjects. I did some philosophy. I did a chemistry subject. I think I did a physics and a biology and I did an IT subject, algorithms subject. And that was the one I loved. And so I thought, well, maybe I just got the wrong idea about this profession. So I switched my degree to a Bachelor of Information Technology, which is what it was at the time, which is a little bit more, you know, business-oriented programming, I suppose, rather than computer science. So a lot of stuff on databases and algorithms but also some things on project management and that kind of thing. So, yeah, I ended up with a Bachelor of Information Technology.
Do you think it helped you in your career?
A little bit. To be perfectly honest, I think I learned more in the first 6 months the first 6 months of actually working than I did in that 4-year degree. There are a few things that I go back to. There's a few science related things like, you know, O-notation for complexity of algorithms and things like that, that I can still rely on my knowledge of that and my learning of that. But for the most part, I think most of the practical knowledge that I have was learned on the job. So, I mean, I'm glad I did the degree. It got me interested in the subject again. It helped me learn how to learn, I suppose. But I don't think it was completely necessary at all for a software development career.
Yeah, this is a theme that I have observed in a lot of the interviews that I do here for mentoring developers. It turns out that you don't really need a programming degree, a computer science, computer engineering, or any kind of IT degree to find success. Certainly, a lot of my superiors in my career they don't have anything to do with computer science as far as their education goes. But that has not hindered them, not only to be successful, but to be even more successful than I was, right? Because they were managing me and nobody ever cared. And, you know, I, on the other hand, went to college and went to graduate school and I studied for years and years and years in college, trying to just learn as much as I could. And then when I got out, I realized I didn't need to do that.
Yeah. It was a little bit difficult, I guess, at the time to get a job in software development. This is 15 years ago in Brisbane, Australia. It was kind of difficult to get a software development job if you didn't have a degree. You would have to kind of, I don't know, maybe enter a company as a technician or, you know, a support person or something like that and work your way in. But that was at the time, and I think the trend is changing a little bit. I think people are realizing that if you can prove that you are a good software developer, then there's no real reason to have a degree attached to, you know, to what you're doing, which I think is a good change. I don't think it should be a requirement necessarily.
Right. So in the US, what I've noticed is that a lot of companies, they want their new employees to have a college degree, but not necessarily in computer science or computer engineering. Well, they're looking for somebody who is maybe educated in other ways, understands how to deal with people, and has a level of comprehension. They feel like that's a good differentiator. So they get thousands, maybe hundreds of resumes per job, and they don't want to go through it. So they feel like it's worthwhile to have that as a filter. But having said that, I know a lot of people who never went to college, and they're very successful. And the reason they are successful is they were able to get their first job. And, and maybe through friends, family, contacts, maybe they worked their way up from QA, just got their foot in the door somehow, then proved themselves. And very soon, the company maybe needed twice as many people, and it was very easy for them to move up. A lot of times I've noticed that in these days, in the last 10 years certainly, you are able to work on your projects even if nobody's hiring you. And then you can show people what you can do because we have the internet now. You can show people what you can do. You can show your code using GitHub. All of a sudden, we have the ability to promote and market our own selves, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And GitHub or something along those lines, you know, that's a much better indicator of like the code that somebody writes than the fact that they have a degree. I knew a handful of people who finished the degree that I finished, and I don't think they'd be able to really write code. I mean, that wasn't really a requirement. You could get through the degree and complete that without being able to, you know, write software. So just saying I have a degree doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be a great developer. Whereas if you have an example of code out there on GitHub, for example, that's a, you know, it's something real and tangible that somebody can look at and say, well, yes, here is code that works and it looks like this. It has a nice architecture. You know, the person knows what they're doing. But having said that, I know there's been a bit of a trend lately as well to say, you know, if you're applying for a job, show us your GitHub account so we can have a look at all of the code that you've written. And so there's almost pressure for people to write, you know, write code in public, even if their day-to-day job doesn't really allow them to do that. So they're almost feeling compelled to, you know, to write code outside of business hours just to prove that they're a real developer. And I think, I don't think that's necessary. I personally have a problem with, you know, with saying, well, if you're not writing code outside of your 9-to-5 job, then you're not a real programmer. I'm a little wary of that being a, you know, an expected requirement for somebody. You might really enjoy it, but there's nothing, you know, maybe you enjoy doing other things outside of your day-to-day job. So there's good parts and bad parts, I guess, right, to having that. But, yeah.
I think for in some parts of our industry, some very specific subcultures within our industry, we have taken this too far. You're absolutely right. Mm. And I have talked to people and I've personally experienced some very strange behavior among recruiters and hiring managers, some people who are not actually going to do the final interview or final determination, but a lot of times they put these filters in because they don't mm-hmm. They don't want to interview 100 people. They want to interview 5 people or 2 people. And they want somebody at a higher level, maybe a human resources person or a hiring manager who's not actually doing the coding, just to filter people out. And they use a degree as a filter. Sometimes we have these keywords. So you have a keywords filter, how many keywords do you have in your resume? And then you have a GitHub profile. And what is your activity level? Again, you know, the heat map for GitHub, how active you have been recently, and that's been used for some reason. And you're absolutely right. A lot of us, in fact, I'm going to say most software developers don't work in open source, and there's no reason why they have to. And what ends up happening is that, as you're saying, we are creating a culture where we are saying that you have to be so passionate and so obsessed with programming that's all you want to do 24/7. And that doesn't mean a person who writes code 24/7 is necessarily a better software developer than somebody who likes to have his 9-to-5 and do a good job and then go home and take care of his kids or play the guitar, for instance. That we assume that if you are not obsessed with this, it's not going to work. In my experience, it happens a lot in startup companies where they don't want somebody who has another passion because they want them to work 12 hours a day.
That's always the danger. Yeah. If you choose somebody who's passionate, then, and you can see that they're working on, you know, side projects and things on an average a few hours a night, then maybe you think as an employer that you can utilize that time as well. I think it's a bit of work-life balance, and I'm probably a bad example of this, actually. Like, I tend to not write a ton of open source stuff, you know, that's out on GitHub. I'll do a little bit, but I also have the problem where especially if my wife is working late, I'll just keep working until she gets home. So I'll do, you know, 18-hour days occasionally. Just because I really enjoy what I'm doing, I don't think that it's necessary for me to do that, though. And in fact, it's probably not healthy for me to do that too often. You need to have some other things going on.
Yeah, 18 hours a day, that may be taking it a little too far, Damon.
Yes,
but
maybe.
But on the other hand, you have a cool job, which we have to talk about now, because you are a developer advocate, but not just a regular one. You're a cloud developer advocate. So a lot of our listeners may not know what a developer advocate is, and a lot of our listeners may not know what a cloud is. So let's talk about what you mean by a cloud and what's a developer advocate.
So we'll start with cloud, I guess, because I was because I'm a bit of a Microsoft person. I work for Microsoft at the moment, so when I talk about cloud, I'm usually talking about Azure, but you know, AWS, Google Cloud Platform are all options as well, and they have awesome features. There's really those three big players in cloud at the moment. So when I talk about cloud, I'm talking about the developer cloud. There's kind of two types, I guess. There's a consumer cloud where you might look at things like Dropbox or I don't know, Apple, iCloud, things like that, where your general consumer, that's where their photos go and their, you know, emails go and all that kind of stuff. The developer cloud is really where programmers will put their stuff. So rather than having a web server that you host, like a rack or a server sitting in an air-conditioned room somewhere in an office that you have to maintain, you put all your stuff on a cloud that Microsoft or Amazon or Google or someone like that manages for you. So you don't really have to worry about the maintenance of the hardware. And in most cases, you don't have to worry about the maintenance of the operating system or anything like that either. You just give it your code, give it the stuff you want to run, and it will run it for you. The company will run it for you, and they charge you, you know, based on usage in most cases. Lately, the developer clouds have started expanding a little bit in what they can do. So traditionally, it was kind of more of a, you know, it's a server that you can rent, essentially. But these days, the cloud is much more about functionality. So things like cognitive services in the Azure cloud. So things like you can upload a bunch of photos and tag them with what's in those photos, and artificial intelligence that Microsoft hosts for you will learn about your photos and be able to answer questions that you have later on. You know, you can give it another photo and say, is John in this photo? And it will give you an answer based on the information that you've given it. So it's really kind of expanding all of the stuff you can do, but not needing to maintain your own hardware and not needing to write, you know, these complex AI algorithms and things like that from scratch yourself. So I guess I've kind of gone off on a couple of little tangents there, but that's really what the cloud is. It's more or less, you know, hosted computing and hosted stuff like that, that you don't have to manage yourself. Microsoft or Amazon or Google or someone like that will manage that for you. So yeah, sorry, I'll take a break.
No, that's great. That's a lot of information. But if I want to talk about the history of what happened here, initially, when maybe 20 years ago, if you wrote a piece of client-server software or a web-based software, then it needs to run on a powerful computer that everybody in the world can access. You could run it on your own computer, but then, you know, it's not always going to be there. And if you have a lot of users, it's not going to work. Obviously, back in the day, we used to run web servers on our own desktops. Guilty of that.
Yes. Yep.
But now we realize, okay, we need servers. We need a dedicated hardware machine that doesn't have necessarily all of the stuff that you need for a computer, for a consumer. It doesn't even have a display, maybe, but it's very hard. It's very fast. It has a fast processor. It has a lot of memory. It can allow a lot of people to connect to that computer at the same time. So that's where we start. And then we make it bigger and make it bigger. And it costs a lot of money to then have this running and make sure it's cool, because it generates a lot of heat. So cooling it, that's expensive. And then a fault appears and you have to replace it and you have downtime. That used to happen a lot. I remember back in the day, a corporate server that's running Exchange, that's handling emails and so on, will go down occasionally. And then we'd have to wait until it's up again. So then now we have, going through that, now a company maybe who has a lot of servers can say, well, why don't you rent mine? And then you don't have to take care of it. We'll take care of it for you. And then we can take care of millions of other people. And now that becomes something like a utility. So you pay for what you use. And behind the scenes, if they have to replace hard disks or if they have to put new servers in, you don't have to worry about that. So now you have a computer that you can just rent on the cloud. So that's where I think this whole cloud thing started. Correct me if I'm wrong. And you'd call it infrastructure as a service. And then after that, people built software on top of that. And so you can have software as a service like Salesforce, that other managed platforms that are running there on top of some kind of cloud infrastructure that you can use as a consumer, and you will not know that it's running in the cloud, or you can offer it to your customers. And then we moved on to platform as a service, where we're just abstracting away even the infrastructure around it, even the framework around it. And all you have to do is, you're dealing with code, And I think that I'm using the correct terminology here, where if I have a piece of code that's supposed to run in a Microsoft server, or if I have a piece of code that's supposed to run in a different type of web server, then maybe Microsoft can give me that web server and I can just tell Microsoft, hey, Microsoft, that's where my code is. Go ahead and run it. And now that we have GitHub and we have the ability to clone and all the wonderful things we can do with Git, I can just tell Microsoft where my GitHub or my Bitbucket repository is, and they can just pull on the code and build it. If it works, then just deploy it. And that's another way. I don't have to know that there is a computer. And then later on, we moved into even more specialized cloud services where we are not even doing an entire program. We're doing just a little snippet. I can provide this little function for you, and it's going to run in the cloud, and there's going to be a server behind it, and there's going to be a hardware, a processor that's processing it, a memory, and then a location, and all of the fault tolerance, and all of that, and patches for the operating system. I have no knowledge of that, and I don't care. All I want to know is that this function will run. So more like some Lambda functions or cloud functions. I don't know what Microsoft is calling it, but lots of platform providers are providing this feature now. So I see that personally, just as an observer, I'm looking at this whole cloud phenomenon as an evolution, and it's almost come to a point where you're expecting that everybody who has large infrastructure needs, who have a lot of users, who may have a lot of load, they are going to use not their dedicated servers, but they're going to use something on the cloud. And I don't know if you can talk a little bit about some of the new features that you see evolving in the cloud.
Yeah, I think you've got that trend exactly right. More and more stuff kind of being taken out of your hands. So, I mean, if you liken it to like an analogy of, you know, electricity, if you had, you know, a little generator in your house that would generate electricity, then you have to maintain that bit of hardware and so on. And then you have to maintain the wiring and stuff like that. And then maybe an electricity company can wire it up to your house. And then you have to worry about the wires that run through the walls of your house and all that kind of stuff. Or you can just rent a place that has, you know, power plugs in all the walls. And as long as something works, you know, as long as you have the right power plug, you can just plug it in. That's kind of this platform as a service where you have code that, you know, is a particular language, and Microsoft and Amazon and Google know how to execute code in that language. You just have to provide the code. You don't need to say, well, this C# ASP.NET code needs to run on an IIS server. You know, it needs to be under this account and all that sort of stuff. You can just say, well, here's the code that I want to run when somebody hits this URL. So that's, you know, Azure Functions gives you that ability to just give Azure a snippet of code or some code and tell it when you need to execute that code, similar to the AWS Lambda that you mentioned as well. And so the trend, I guess, is probably taking more and more of that away from the developer, where you don't need to worry about the things that are pretty much commodity. I mean, if every time you ran a web application, it was on an IIS server running on a Windows machine, and you gave it, you know, you gave it C# code, but you have to set up that Windows server and the IIS machine, then let Microsoft do that for you. There are other advantages that you get for this as well, where let's say you have an e-commerce site that only really operates in the US. It might have a lot of traffic, you know, between 5 p.m. and midnight, for example, every weekday. But between, you know, 3 and 4 a.m., nobody's visiting that site. If you had your own server, whether it's your server or, you know, an infrastructure as a service, you know, rented server from a cloud provider, then you have to worry about, you know, what electricity is that using when nobody's using it? You know, we need to have a machine that's capable of handling the largest load, but also capable of handling, you know, also can go down to nothing, you know, so we're wasting all this electricity and all this power. If you use a cloud provider and just say, here's my application, I want you to scale it depending on how many people are hitting the thing, then you're not actually getting charged anything if nobody's hitting your site. And if suddenly, you know, you hit a major news program or something like that, and you have millions of people hitting your site in one go, then Azure or, you know, whoever it is can scale your application up or scale the hardware behind it up to handle that load. And you don't really need to worry about those intricacies. So that's another advantage, I guess, of doing that, just giving it the code and letting the, you know, Microsofts and Amazons and Googles kind of work out the stuff that is just a bit painful to manage yourself.
That's true. I'm a big proponent of adopting the cloud as your backbone, because I personally don't enjoy doing a lot of the infrastructure work, right? You have to do it when you're building something from scratch or when you're testing it. But regular maintenance, I don't know any developer who likes doing that. So I appreciate all that. However, I'm just thinking of the conversation we had before we started recording, that your focus these days is on DevOps. And we have had DevOps discussed on this podcast before, where you are doing some development, some operations, you're actually doing something with infrastructure, right? You're not just writing code. So maybe let's take 30 seconds to talk about what DevOps is, then I'll ask you my question.
Sure. So DevOps is kind of it means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. I come from a software developer background. So when I think about DevOps, I kind of think about it as, you know, reproducible ways to deploy my code, test it successfully, and make sure that everything works the way it's supposed to work. So Microsoft actually has a definition of DevOps, which was written by my boss, Donovan Brown, which is the union of people, process, and products to enable continuous delivery of value to our end users, which is really, really broad. And it really just refers to changing the way you operate so that you have a focus on actually delivering value rather than, you know, writing a particular feature that's on your backlog, for example. And that value could also be things like scaling up your web server if it's, you know, if you have a lot of traffic, or being able to, you know, recover from a failure if there's an internet problem in one of your data centers or something like that. But really the focus is on making sure that you can quickly and repeatedly, you know, push software out or infrastructure changes out. If you come from DevOps with a background in system administration and operations and things like that, there's a lot more emphasis on making sure that, you know, your infrastructure is fault tolerant and things are able to be repaired quickly, and you can rebuild servers if they need to be rebuilt and so on. But it all kind of fits into the idea of DevOps as, you know, delivering this stuff to your users in a way that adds value to them, you know, quickly and efficiently, and, you know, doing your best to make sure that it works the way it's supposed to work.
I think that's a very good definition. The way I've heard it described by some other people that I've listened to in the past is essentially you're taking responsibility not only for the correct function of your software, but its correct operation, which means if something is wrong in the infrastructure, if there's anything wrong that stops your production site from functioning, then instead of these two different persons, one responsible for fixing the code and pushing it out, and the other person responsible for making sure it keeps running, we combine these two roles into one person who's responsible for both. So my question was, if you think of DevOps like this, and it makes sense if I'm running a hardware rack in the back of my office, and then I have to manage so many different things, and then it makes sense for efficiency's sake that one person who knows the product or the software intimately would be responsible for making sure it runs, and hope that once you have identified and ironed out some of the kinks, then it continues to run. And if there's a problem that pops up, that same person is notified and they're familiar with it. That makes sense. But I'm wondering how that works in the cloud, because now I feel like a lot of that responsibility is just taken over by the cloud company. Microsoft is doing the patches. Microsoft is maybe even pulling my code down and they're deploying it. So does that mean we don't need DevOps anymore?
No, I don't think so at all. So it does change a little bit with the cloud, but rather than your kind of busy work of making sure that patches are up to date and you know, you have the appropriate network connectivity and things like that, your emphasis can be more on making sure that everything is running correctly and efficiently and things like that. Even if you back up to the deployment of the software, where your job may have previously been, you know, provisioning a server, so ordering something from a manufacturer and getting it in and putting it in the racks and wiring it up and installing all the software and the operating systems and making sure everything's right. You don't have to worry about that stuff anymore, but you still need to. You still need experts who are able to say, well, this is what this application means. This is what this application actually needs to run. And so the DevOps role can kind of transition to this, or the traditional DevOps role, or traditional operations role, I guess, can transition a bit more to, well, the resources that we need to run this application are these things. There's a web application that runs under app services in Azure, for example. Here are the scaling settings that we need. So once it hits a particular, you know, percentage of usage, then scale up to another one. Maybe we need to separate that resource group from another one to provide a bit of isolation. Here's an entire, you know, development or test environment that's going to duplicate that. But more importantly, here's the monitoring that's required for this as well. Here are the thresholds that mean that we need to look at something that's going wrong. If there are more than this many exceptions in a particular period of time, then you need to be notified, and we need to make sure that the information we get is such that we can identify what the actual problems are. So there's still plenty of work to do in that respect. In terms of the actual deployment of the software too, there's a lot that goes on there. If you're writing a website, for example, it's not really just enough to say, well, here's my web application. There's my code. That is my website. You know, go do the sync whenever it's required. Usually there's plenty of other stuff that needs to happen. There are databases involved. There are other backend systems that need connectivity. There's notifications that need to go out to people. There's approval processes to get things, you know, approved to go into production. So that whole process as well becomes part of what you know, the DevOps, you know, role, I guess, is. When I say DevOps role, by the way, this is kind of something that the team should own rather than having an individual DevOps team or an individual DevOps person. Their ownership should really belong to the entire team. And you may have operations specialists, you may have monitoring specialists, you may have you know, software, but the programmers themselves who are specialists on the application as well. But the team as a whole owns what ends up in production.
Yep, I think that's an excellent answer. DevOps is alive and well, folks. So if you're listening to this podcast and you were having second thoughts about DevOps as a feature of your career, don't give up. There's hope. So in this podcast, we like to talk about the technologies that people are working on, because it's really fun and exciting to know that there are so many different possibilities, and this is an opportunity for us to learn. So really appreciate, Damien, that you gave us a chance to learn from you about your experiences, about what you're passionate about. But we also want to talk about how you got started and how you got your first break or your first job. Because a lot of us are struggling. We may have some coursework in computer science, or we may have a degree, or we may have some experience maybe doing side projects. We may have a little bit of experience, but a lot of us are just struggling to get our first job. So from your point of view, I would love to know how you got your first job.
My story of getting the first job is probably not terribly exciting. I finished university, got a resume together, and then started applying for positions. The first job I got was a government one, And it was actually in a language that I hadn't really touched very much, which was all the .NET stuff. So it was kind of, it was very traditional, kind of finished my degree and then applied for a job and went to a few interviews and then got an offer. Subsequent jobs, though, have been very different. There have been a few that I kind of applied for, but especially lately, I've kind of followed what I'm interested in. So the really great thing about software, I think, is that there are so many different like areas that you can go into, and you can fall into stuff that you really like, and and it can be completely different than the person next to you. I have a bunch of people who I went to university with. We did exactly the same degree, but we barely speak the same language when it comes to writing software, even though we, you know, technically are both software developers. So there's a huge range. I think that the climate that I was in at the moment, it was just important to get a job and any job. But I don't know whether that's the case anymore. I think these days it's a bit more important to find something that aligns with what you enjoy about software, rather than just picking up any job that's available. But of course, if that is what you end up doing, just picking up any job that's available, you can definitely lead towards the stuff that you do enjoy, which is kind of where I ended up.
Sometimes you have to take a few steps before you get to your destination. What I've noticed is, in a lot of cases, I've found successful software developers, when they started, they did not start in jobs or in not even in places where they wanted to be, but they just lucked into being surrounded by other people who were really knowledgeable and really helpful, even though they were doing something else. And just by being in that environment, they were able to learn and they were able to grow. So there's opportunity. Obviously, you should, if you're a new software developer and you want a job, there are many ways of getting it. And we talk about this on this podcast. If you want to learn more about some of the different ways how you could get a job, you know, personally, if you're a listener, go ahead and email me at us@mentoringdevelopers.com and I will reply. I'll send you some resources and we can start a conversation. So if you could start over, Damien, what would you do differently as a new developer? Is there things that you kind of did and like, I wish I hadn't done that?
I don't know whether there's anything I wouldn't do, but what I would definitely do is some things a bit earlier than I did. It took me a while to realize that I could pursue the parts of the job that I was interested in. I kind of thought for the first maybe 7 or 8 years of being a programmer, I kind of thought I was at the mercy of whoever was employing me. And every bit of software development I did was going to be based on exactly what my boss told me it was going to be. And I was going to end up being pigeonholed in a particular language, particular type of software, and things like that. It took me probably about that long, about 8 years, to realize that, you know, I can read stuff that I'm interested in. I can emphasize the parts of the job that I like, even without really changing my job. So we kind of have a saying in my group, the DevOps focused cloud developer advocates at Microsoft, that you shouldn't ask permission to do your job properly. So if you as a programmer think that it is really important for you to speak to the customer about what they actually meant when they asked for this feature, then you shouldn't really need to ask for permission to speak to the customer or to write tests if you think tests are important. You can just do that. That's part of being a professional. And so I think that led me eventually to where I am now, where I thought, you know, one of the things that I really enjoy is learning new stuff and then teaching it to other people. And so I started doing that. I would, find a bit of code that I had to write as part of a feature that, you know, that was my job description, essentially, is to write this particular feature. So I would find a part of that I was quite interested in and delve a little bit deeper into how to make that work really well. And then once I'd learned, oh, look, there's this great algorithm for, you know, compressing images or something like that. It's fascinating. I ended up teaching other people that, you know, those little bits of information because I found that very interesting. And that's kind of led to this developer advocacy thing where that's kind of my job is I learn things and I teach other people. So even within my own job, I was able to kind of focus a little bit more on the things that I liked. And then maybe my next job would focus even more on those things. And the one after that might focus, you know, even more. And you kind of make your own path rather than being pigeonholed. But it took me a long time to realize that, you know, that I was able to do that.
I think this is excellent advice. Obviously, you can think outside the box. And a lot of times our managers or people who are managing us, they don't really know what we should do, right? A lot of times a new developer would go in and think that the people who are managing them or who are more senior know exactly how to tackle every situation. So they need to be told what to do because I don't know and that person knows everything. In a lot of cases, we are all learning. And a lot of times when we start a software project, we may not even know what to do, even if we have 10, 15, 20, 30 years experience, because maybe we've never done something exactly like that. And so if a junior person comes up and takes initiative and goes and reaches out to a customer or writes tests, we're mostly, most of us are going to appreciate that. Right. And there's, and yeah. Obviously I have been in situations, Damien, where it is not appreciated. So let me be clear. yep. Writing tests or talking to customers is scoffed at. It happens in situations where maybe some of that is not billable or some of that does not add to the bottom line of the company. Those type of political things, they happen. But for most organizations that are, especially for in-house developers or people who are really invested in the success of the software product, they will appreciate any initiative that you can show. Because that means they don't have to think for you. You can think for yourself. You're going to be an asset to the company, not a liability.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I've worked in plenty of those places as well where, you know, tests are the things you write at the end if you have time. And of course, you never have time. So, I mean, in those scenarios, I think you just have to do your best at doing what you think is the best thing for, you know, for writing good software, for delivering value to customers. But at some point, if you're not getting any momentum and, you know, you can't change that culture and you feel like it really needs to change, then maybe the thing that needs to change is what job you're in. So, yeah, I mean, there are organizations that are just going to say, well, no, we don't have time to do DevOps. We don't have time to do Agile. We don't have time to do tests. You know, and there's not a lot you can do to change that. What you can change is, you know, where you work, ideally.
Yeah, what's exciting about 2018 and beyond is that there are so many jobs and so many jobs, regardless of where you live, because there's a lot of remote jobs as well. So if you live in a city or a town where you don't have a lot of opportunities, maybe there is an opportunity somewhere else. So don't give up. And if you're in a situation which is hurting you from becoming a good software developer, a good professional, right? A lot of times work environments are not professional. So you should feel free to move on. And even if you are at a dream job, that you shouldn't think that you're going to retire from there. I think our society as a whole has moved on from that idea of getting a job and then staying there forever, because at least in the US, the employers don't guarantee you a job at all. And so you shouldn't feel that you're obligated to stay there until everything falls apart. And that doesn't mean that I don't encourage job hopping a little. I've seen some really aggressive job hopping in my career, mm-hmm. where some people would change jobs in weeks or a couple of months. That doesn't give you anything.
Yeah, definitely. You could definitely try to change what happens in the organization before just jumping away. I think my average is about 3 years, 2.5, 3 years in a job. And then I leave not just because, or not really because, you know, I hate the place, I can't work here anymore. I leave more because I don't feel like I'm growing anymore. I'm doing the same stuff day to day. I'm not learning anything new. You know, it's not working out for either party then. You know, they basically have somebody doing exactly the same thing that anybody else could do. And I'm not learning, I'm not enjoying it. You know, it's time to move on. But, you know, you do, if something's not working, then it'd be great for the company and for yourself if you were able to change that in the organization. And you can't do that in a week. So, you know, give it a go for a while. And if it's just not working, then maybe look at other options. I think, yeah, I think that's good advice. Still there?
Yes. So I was on mute and I didn't realize I was on mute. So the most important thing that I'd like to tell new developers is just don't give up. Stay in the game, because if you stay in the game long enough, you will succeed, because there's plenty of opportunity out there and there's something just right for you. Obviously, if you don't like software development, then don't be a software developer. But if you want to be a software developer, let nothing stop you. A bad job, a bad boss, bad technology choices, all of that can change. You can change. I've seen companies change from within, completely be transformed. A bad boss can leave and a new boss can come in. Or maybe you would become the boss. That happens too. Or a bad set of technologies. I've seen situations where a company is using really old technology. That's all they know. And all of a sudden, there's a new budget, there's more money. And if you talk to the right people, all of a sudden the technology stack changes and now they're agile and they're doing scrums and they have, you know, Kanban boards going and all of a sudden you're working in open source or some other technology that you're excited about. So it can happen. Or you can just move on and find another job. Or maybe you know, if you have a couple of years experience, maybe go out on your own. I've seen people become independent consultants. I've done that, and that sometimes that works out really well. So 2018, if you're listening to this podcast in 2018 or 2019 and so on, you're in a good place. This is a good time to be a software developer. Right, Damien?
Definitely.
I would agree. It's been a pleasure talking to you. So much amazing advice. And I think people are going to love this episode. There's so many more questions I could ask you, but we're coming up to an hour and I think we need to stop. But before we go, I want to give you a chance, Damien, to talk to my audience, give them a message if you like, give an advice, or talk about something that you're working on that you're passionate about that you'd like them to check out.
Oh, there's so many things. Well, one thing I guess I would say, and this is as a result of me starting to work at Microsoft about 8 months ago, Microsoft is a very different company for developers than it used to be. Our documentation, like a huge amount of our code is on GitHub now. It's all open source. The whole developer advocacy group, which is the group that I'm part of inside Microsoft, our job description is literally, you know, help people succeed. So I would, if you're, you know, in the industry and you're a little bit jaded about Microsoft from the days of, you know, forcing upgrades and all sorts of other stuff that went on a while ago, have another look. You know, Azure is primarily Linux servers these days. You know, we have Microsoft is one of the largest contributors to the Linux code base. And I think the largest contributor to open source, according to some GitHub stats, as a company as well. So it's a very different story these days. I'd have another look. If you want to learn how to use any of Azure as well, the great starting point is docs.azure.com. Oh, sorry, docs.microsoft.com. I knew I'd get that wrong. docs.microsoft.com. There's awesome walkthroughs and videos and all sorts of stuff. And you can absolutely reach out to any of the cloud developer advocates too. It should be very easy to find. I think it's developer.microsoft.com. And we'll be on there. And that's our job, to help you succeed. And to some extent, whether you're using Microsoft stuff or not, So reach out if you're having any problems with anything. Have a look at the docs. Things have changed at Microsoft.
And if you want to talk to Damien, or if you want to send him a message, and if you can't find him, you can always find me at mentoringdevelopers.com. This is going to be episode 66, so you can find links for everything that Damien is talking about, and show notes and transcripts at mentoringdevelopers.com/episode66. It's easy. So if you want to find another episode, let's say episode 60, all you have to do is mentoringdevelopers.com/episode60. So all URLs are fun like that. And I'm also very responsive in email us at mentoringdevelopers.com. If you want to send a message to Damien and you want to ask me and Damien something, I will make sure I forward your requests to Damien if you want, or you can reach out to Damien directly. All right, Damien, it was a pleasure talking to you.
You too, Aslan. Thank you very much for making the time.
Thank you so much. And thank you, everybody, for listening. See you later. Hi, folks. It's really good to know that you made it to the end of this episode. Did you enjoy listening to it? Did you have any questions that you wanted to ask, or maybe some suggestions? Fire me an email at us@mentoringdevelopers.com and I'll see to it that it gets responded. Also, go ahead and sign up for the email list if you have not done that already. Go to mentoringdevelopers.com and you'll be able to sign up for email list. And once you do, I'll send you my 5 steps to success as a software developer, and also send you information about salary negotiations and how to get better salaries. And you can ask me any questions you want over there, and I'll be able to answer it through email personally. Also, if you're interested in getting a free t-shirt about diversity that I've designed, then go ahead and ask me a question. If your question is good and it gets featured on the podcast, you will be eligible to win a free t-shirt. A pretty cool t-shirt, if I may say myself. Once again, thanks for listening and stay in touch.
For show notes and transcripts, visit us at mentoringdevelopers.com.